Ready for point number four on this outline I'm giving you of the responsibilities of elders to the congregation. And point number four is this. An elder must be an alert, perceptive individual. Now, to be alert and perceptive, it means essentially, and to simplify it, it just means that he sees and knows what's going on. So he has to be observant. He has to watch people. He has to watch the reactions of people. He has to be conversant with the moods that people get into. He has to be a student, in other words, of human nature. Because what Rick was talking about in the family refers to this family too. He has to know the children of God here. They can't all be treated alike. They can't all be talked to the same. They can't all be motivated the same way. Jude said this very clearly. He said, of some, we must make a difference. We can shock some. We can give them the rush treatment, yank them out of the fire. But he said, with others, that won't work. And remember what Paul said about being all things to all men so that he might by all means gain some. Apply these principles, in other words, to the congregation, and you realize that we're not all cut from the same cloth. We don't all think alike. We don't all react alike. We are a diverse group. So the elder must be very alert. He must be perceptive. In that connection, I'd like to give you Ezekiel 3, verse 17, where God said to this prophet, Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. That's your function. And Hebrews 13, 17 tells us that the elder serves the same function. He is a watchman. He watches for the souls of the members. Now, a watchman does a number of different things. I don't want to go into this very much in the interest of time, but let me just deal with two aspects of this quickly. A watchman, first of all, must sound the alarm when he sees danger. Now, sounding the alarm implies, in other words, that if one elder sees a problem, he must immediately go to the other elders. Do they also see it? If he has certain well-read, level-headed members of the church, he might ask one of them, do you see this? Are you aware of this? This, in other words, is to check his own perception of how widespread this might be. Perhaps he saw an isolated incident. Perhaps that's as far as it goes. But if this is a general trend, then you see we have an instant danger. So he must sound the alarm. He must sound out other people, see whether or not his own perception of this situation is accurate. Also, a watchman reacts when he sees danger. Whatever he can do to prevent something from happening, he will do. And bear in mind that preventive discipline is far, far better than corrective. If we can stop something from happening, this is the general function of the watchman. He tries to keep a business from being robbed by his presence and his actions. He can't do very much about something that's already happened. That's out of his hands. So his function is to keep it from happening. And that, I think, is the most important thing that an elder can do as a watchman over spiritual Israel. Now, under this point of being alert, perceptive, there are certain examples, certain things I want to give you. A, he must be alert for friction between members. Every once in a while this will happen because of disagreements. And this can involve individuals or it can involve larger numbers of persons. Unfortunately, sometimes there are some cliques in the church. There are some little pockets of we stick togetherness in the church. And sometimes those are at odds with each other. That must be picked up on. We're told in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 25, that the members should have the same care for one another. We should not divide ourselves into little groups. We should not fragment the church, because it's exactly like Jesus said, "United we stand, divided we fall. A house divided against itself cannot stand." And whether that's Satan's house or the church, it's true. B, neglect. If an elder sees someone that is guilty of neglect, attendance is probably the most common sign of neglect that an elder will see. And of course, we're told not to. Hebrews 10:25, the word forsake also carries with it the connotation of neglect. So if we neglect the church, this is a sign of trouble. But neglect shows its head in other areas. I might neglect to do my assignment well. I drag my feet a little bit. I don't properly prepare. I might neglect a responsibility that I have been assigned. I might neglect to keep an appointment. I might neglect to pass along something I should have told someone. You gave me a message and I just got careless and didn't even pass it along. There are many ways we can be guilty of neglect. The elder must pick up on this to the best of his ability. Also, C, he should be alert for confusion. If members are mixed up about something, they didn't get the whole story, they weren't properly informed, he should make a public announcement, the FYI kind, and just simply let them know the score. Tell them exactly what happened so that there'll be no misunderstandings. D, we may have upset persons for one reason or another. Now, the upset may have nothing to do with the church. It can be something that happened at home. It could be a broken relationship. It could be some argument between people that has hurt both parties somewhat. It could be a misunderstanding. But if there are hurt or upset persons, and we show this more or less by our behavior, we're a little pouty perhaps, a little sullen, we become a little uncooperative, and we show signs that we're not functioning just right. This is something an elder should pick up on if he can. E, if some members of the congregation are developing some wrong ideas, now this is not false teaching, I'm not talking about this, but I mean wrong ideas about procedure, how we do things. They thought, well, I thought I was supposed to do this. In other words, I didn't quite understand just what was expected of me. And I have some wrong ideas about various things. These should be quickly corrected as soon as we spot them. We don't want to let these fester either. Point number five. He must know the flock. A shepherd knows his sheep. And he knows these things about them. A, he knows their tendencies. Are they nervous? Does he have a flock that jumps at the slightest thing? Have they been recently attacked, for example? Have they recently been through a traumatic situation? Are they still a little shaken? Now, animals who have been through recent dangers will just stand and tremble sometimes. They will show the signs of recent traumatic action. People do this too. Now, we show a little calmer exterior than the animal. Our trembling is going on inside. And sometimes it goes on for a considerable space of time. But when this happens, and we know that the congregation has a tendency to do that, then we have to do some exhorting. We have to do some encouraging. We have to know how to make people feel better. We have to help them recover from these fears of danger. And that means, point B, that we must know their strengths and their weaknesses. On the outside of the flock, there may be a ewe that has a hard time keeping up. We have elderly people in the church. What are their needs? How should we treat them? What are their particular weaknesses that we can help with? And this is an area where an elder many times can ask the help of other members of the congregation. If he sees that something needs to be shored up a little bit, if he sees a weakness, someone who knows that person, someone close sometimes, is the best supporter. And he might ask that person to be very careful, be diligent in that area. If a congregation has certain strengths, in other words, if they are a group that really contributes well, this is something that is quite an advantage to a congregation. They can schedule more work. They can do more things. They can help more people. They can help other congregations. They have more possibilities. If this is a congregation strong in the sense of working together, then you're not afraid to ask the group to do something because they're perfectly capable and willing of pulling together to get something done well. These strengths and these weaknesses are congregation-wide sometimes, and sometimes they are personal. But whether they are individual or congregational, they must be addressed. We know the strengths and weaknesses of the church. C, we must have reasonable expectations of the congregation we administer if we're an elder. We know their limitations. We know things that they probably can't handle. We understand that certain individuals have come just this far in their growth. We don't push them beyond what they're able. In handling animals of all kinds, some of you have had the experience, perhaps, of driving milk cows. Well, you don't drive a milk cow at breakneck speed because, in the first place, she may injure herself. Also, if her udders are full, she'll lose a lot of milk before she gets to the barn. And also, she will get hot. On a hot day, you wouldn't dare do that. In other words, you have to be reasonable in your expectations of what a group can do. You can't drive people. You can lead them, but you can't drive them. So don't try to drive them. That's an unreasonable expectation. If you know the capabilities of people in the sense of lodging people, then deal with them according to those capabilities. Some people are happy to have 9 or 10 people in their house. Some people can't handle but 1 or 2. This is a difference in, not altogether a difference in facilities. It is a difference in attitude and willingness and a number of things. Reasonable expectations. This doesn't necessarily mean that you agree with someone in what they do. Doesn't mean that you wouldn't like for them to do better sometimes. But if you know where they are, you can't reasonably expect them to change that immediately. Point D, you must be able to spot individuals with particular abilities or potential to do certain things. If you have someone with the potential to lead, you should know it. If someone is strictly a follower, you should know it. If someone is a good group worker, you should know it. The particular abilities and talents of the congregation are absolutely essential for the elder to recognize. If he sees these, and if he recognizes them properly, he can elicit a lot of help and get it. He can encourage people to begin studying or training for certain things. For example, if you see leadership ability in a young man, start him thinking about becoming a deacon. Start him thinking about becoming a teacher, taking a leading role in the church. Get him headed in that direction if you can, because we shouldn't overlook people who can lead. We need a lot of leadership in the church. Now, sometimes these are abilities and sometimes these are talents. An ability is something that is natural. A talent is generally something you have developed or that has grown along with you. Something you've recognized, something you've liked, something you've wanted to do, and you've developed it, so it becomes a talent. Recognize both of these and be able to separate them. Don't expect a talented person necessarily to have all the abilities, because these aren't the same thing. I have seen talented people who didn't have the ability to lead. I've seen people with the ability to lead who might not be as talented as someone else, but nonetheless, people would follow them. So we must be able to separate these, be judicious in our decisions in this area so that we don't mix up and come out with the wrong persons doing the right things and the right persons doing the wrong things. We need to place people, if we possibly can, where they can function best. Not only does this help the church, but this gives the individual a feeling of belonging, self-satisfaction, and fulfillment. And those are good feelings to have in the church. E, how does the congregation respond to various things? For example, praise. Suppose an elder compliments the congregation highly. How do they respond to that? Do they become a little puffed up, a little proud of themselves? Maybe we're a little more up and coming than some of the other congregations. Is that the way they respond? How do they respond, for example, to rebuke? Does it humble the group a little, or do they get belligerent? Do they just decide they'll show him bad behavior if he wants to see it? How do they react? What does he have to do? In other words, based on how he realizes they will react, his approach will depend absolutely on knowing that. Otherwise, he'll be a blind man going in. He has to understand how they react. How do you keep a congregation in a reasonably good frame of mind? Well, it's a blend of several things. A little praise, a little rebuke, and a little honest, objective appraisal. Also, a little back patting, a little rebuking here and there, a little seasoning of the whole thing with spiritual salt. You try to keep the congregation in a reasonably good frame of mind, just like you would your family at home. If someone isn't in a reasonably good frame of mind, then you try to help them because you don't like people down in the doldrums. You ask yourself, for example, what is the present atmosphere of the congregation? Is it positive? Is it more or less neutral? Negative? Is it hopeful? Is it despair? What is the particular atmosphere of the congregation? And how we deal with that depends on the atmosphere. Now, atmosphere is present even in writing, even in speaking. Everyone creates a particular atmosphere. Some writers are very angry. Some are happy. very optimistic. Some are suspicious. Some are vindictive. And you can tell by what they say and how they say it. And that creates the atmosphere for what they're saying. So however we function, we create an atmosphere of some kind. Hopefully that will be reasonably good. Hopefully not negative. Now that comes by knowing the flock, understanding their reactions to all kinds of situations, knowing about how they feel about most things. And the last point I want to give you here, he must be acquainted with all the members. He must know that flock by personal acquaintance. Now, I know that some people are easier to talk to than others. I understand this very well. This doesn't mean that he has the same closeness with every member. I don't think that's possible. But he has to have a good working relationship with each family in the church, if that's at all possible. I know that's an ideal, but I state it as a possibility. It can be done, although it isn't easy. Sometimes families don't help the elder very much in that process. They resist considerably his overtures. We'll get to that when we deal with the responsibility of the congregation to the elders. So if you think I'm giving the elders a going over, wait till I get to you. We're ready for point number 6 in the outline, which is he must protect or guard the flock. You can say it either way. 1 Peter 5, verse 2. Now, point A in this is from any noxious element. And that would include false teachers, which we've already commented on. But it wouldn't necessarily have to be a false teacher. A congregation that I visited several times, in fact, I spoke for them off and on, I guess, maybe every couple of months for a couple of years. And they had so many problems, it was difficult to know where to begin. But the underlying problem in that congregation had to do with a song leader. He was a comedian. And he felt that he had to behave this way in the church. So when the congregation came together, he would get up to lead the singing. And instead of leading the singing for 20 minutes, we have a kidding and a joking session with all the members for a full 20 minutes of the 1 hour that they were to meet. Then he would finally pick up his songbook, and someone would suggest a number, and he'd say, "Oh, that's not in my book." In other words, still trying to be a comedian. And every time he got up, this happened. He was related closely or distantly to nearly everyone in the congregation, and there were about 100 people there on a Sunday morning, and he was rather dear to all of them, so no one ever called him down, no one ever corrected him, no one ever told him that he was ruining the service. But what eventually happened was that the whole congregation was encouraged to take religion very lightly. And I had never seen a congregation that took their responsibility to God as lightly as that one. As a matter of fact, their contribution for 2 weeks was 11 cents. That's how lightly they took their responsibilities. 3 elders, one could teach, the other two couldn't even offer prayer. They took their responsibility, in other words, of choosing qualified people very lightly. And all of that could be traced back because the church hadn't been like that before he became a part of it. So a lot of it had to be laid at his door. He had simply encouraged the congregation to become casual in their attitude toward God and everything in the Scriptures. It was one mess. I can tell you this. It didn't even remotely resemble the church. But there was a sign over the door, Church of Christ. In that community, most people either smoked or chewed, and they would spit on the floor, grind out their cigarettes under their heels inside the building. They treated it about as casually as they'd have treated the front yard. That didn't mean anything to them either. In other words, it just permeated all of their thinking and their behavior anytime they were near that building. Not much matter, just any old thing goes. And that's the way they thought. So it isn't all false teaching. He wasn't engaging in anything false. He was just absolutely wasting their time. So sometimes there are things in the church that the elder must object to, must protect the congregation from, that are permeating influences that have nothing to do with bad teaching. All right, point B. He must protect the church from attacks without. You remember in Acts 20, verses 29-30, that Paul warned the elders that there would be attacks from within, false teaching, but also attacks without. Wolves from without would attack the flock, not sparing the members of that flock. He warned them about that. All right, what happens from the outside that hurts the church? Sometimes there are people in the community that just decide that they don't like the church for some reason. It could be because they've had a little disagreement or run in with some member. Perhaps they've seen a member that acted a little hypocritically. Sometimes it doesn't take much to set them off, but they set out individually to blacken the name of the church in that community. And they tell these stories everywhere they go. Now these begin to filter into the congregation. They begin to pick up on this. This is very discouraging. This is very bad for morale. The elder must encourage the church to ignore this. And he may have to work very hard with some individual members who have been hurt badly by this, especially some perhaps that have been really cut deeply by some things that have been said about them personally. And we have attacks from without. We are attacked from the media, not directly, but indirectly, almost every time they put something on the screen. Our morals are degraded, ridiculed. Our whole way of life is held up as stupid by the media. The whole world, in other words, John said, lies in wickedness. All of that is an indirect attack on the church. And all of these forces, everything in the world that bears in upon us, elders as the leaders of the flock must try to encourage the congregation not to be discouraged by. We just simply cannot worry about those things overmuch, or we become so discouraged that we're ready to quit. What's the use, we say? Nobody will listen. They're all against us. We don't want to get paranoid, you see. So we must have a cheerleader sometimes for a leader who can encourage us and get us over these discouragements and negative thoughts. So these attacks simply must not dismay us. Point C. He must protect us against discouragement. And I think this comes often in small congregations more than in large, where we have only a few members, not a great deal of talent, not much ability. Several of these are elderly. We don't see a good future there, we believe, and so we don't try very hard. We just get discouraged. We don't talk much to other people. What's the point? We're all going to die off and the church will be gone. How many times have I heard that? Well, we're not going to die off unless we let it happen. We've got to get some new blood here. We have to get busy and get out and be disciples in the real sense. We must convert some people. But discouragement, we get down at the mouth. We think we can't do anything, and we just let things drag. And that is a disaster. D, We cannot be turned aside from our course by fear. If a congregation becomes a little fearful, now what would scare a congregation? Quite a number of years ago, we had a tremendous scare of nuclear war. I was teaching in Springfield at that time, and one of the students in my speech and debate class had a father who made a great deal of money building underground shelters. That was big business for a few years. Now, how is the church to react to an international scare like that? Essentially, we don't react. No reaction is the best reaction in that case. Because not one of us could do a thing about that situation. Now, what I cannot do anything about, there isn't any point in my stewing and fretting about. I'm just wasting my energies. So the attitude of the church had to be, if it comes, it comes. If it doesn't, it doesn't. We serve God, we do the best that we can, and don't worry about it. That's what you do in case of things that you might otherwise fear. Now, there are various fears that creep into society that we discuss. We talk about joblessness. We talk about the economy. We talk about trying to build up the community. We get discouraged because maybe there are no ballparks. There are no tennis courts for our kids to play on. The various things that cause us to be apprehensive about raising our children, doing various things. But take this advice from Paul. He was warned, not once, but multiple times about going to Jerusalem. Probably the prophet Agabus was most specific. And he told him, Paul, if you go there, bonds and imprisonment await you. That's very specific. The bonds immediately, the imprisonment a little later, but both in the offing. And his answer, I think, should encourage all of us. He said, none of these things move me. He told people, don't cry and break my heart. Don't weep over me. Don't feel sorry for me. Don't worry about what's going to happen to me, because I am ready not only to be bound, but also to die for the Lord Jesus. I'm ready. You don't have to worry about me. I'm prepared. Whatever comes, I'm ready. And I think his attitude must be our attitude. Then one further point, point E. The elder must protect the congregation from what I call spiritual inbreeding. No new ideas, ever. I'm familiar with one or two congregations, one in particular, some in a little less, but let me describe this one. They were literally afraid to invite any preachers there for fear they would hear something false. Now, this was a reaction to an earlier problem when falsehood was taught in the brotherhood, but that was long since behind them. 20 years later, here they sit, still scared to death that somebody may come in and teach something false. Well, of the preachers they could have invited, they would have no fear. None of those people would have taught anything false because those were the people who stood against that doctrine at the time and opposed it. And they certainly haven't changed their mind since. But they were just simply afraid of what people would teach. Afraid of any new idea. Afraid of any expression they hadn't heard before. Afraid that somebody might see something a little differently. And other than one preacher, they went along for years and years, never hearing anybody else, never getting any other input. You see, they had essentially the same problem there that you would have with a full-time preacher in a church. You get his ideas, but nobody else's. You get his in great abundance. But you're not getting a variety. You're not getting different approaches to the same thing. You're not getting different minds handling the same thing. See, that's one of the evils of that system. You have spiritual inbreeding, and it gets very, very bad. But we can get the same thing if elders are reluctant to expose the congregation to different persons, if you will. This is one of the reasons why, no matter how strong the church is, no matter how good the eldership is, no matter how good the teaching is, they should invite different people in to speak sometimes. We need to get a different slant on things. We need to hear different people. We need to listen to different expressions on different subjects. It's good for us. We need to be shaken up a little. So we have to watch that spiritual inbreeding, and it's primarily an elder's responsibility to take care of this. And to the extent that he thinks the church needs it, he should urge that it be done. Some congregations need more of this than others. It depends a lot on how much talent the congregation has. It depends upon the abilities of the several members. If we have many members who are expert edifiers, we don't need as much of this. If the church is basically weak in the ability to edify itself, we need more of this. We have to judge according to the needs and react accordingly. Point number 7 in the outline. He must feed and nourish the flock. Now, we made a comment on teaching, and you can put that as point A, that it must be good, his technique, the quality, everything. We've already mentioned that, so I don't want to say any more about that, except to say that that also applies to the teaching of others, not only himself. Now, I spoke of the elder individually. Now, we're including in this point the teaching of others. He must be just as aware of how they teach as how he teaches. Now, there are some persons who don't know how to get people involved in a lesson. They seem to feel that they should get up and lecture, that their voice should be the only one heard. I have had a sneaking suspicion sometimes that people were so fond of hearing their own voice, they couldn't hush. But a good teacher gets the class involved. So how well do other people teach? The elder also is interested in this. Not only his own, but what about the others that perform? Whether they are members of the congregation or people you might ask to come and stay with you a few days. Just exactly what do they do best? How skillful are they? How much good will it do the congregation to hear them? Now, I don't know whether any of you would agree with this in your own experience, but I have listened to a series of 5 sermons that didn't help me in any way. Many times, incidentally. Many times. Because they were simply a rehash of what we all already know. Now, I'm not saying that a common subject will always be a rehash. If you come at it from a little different point of view, if you approach it differently, that's very worth our while. But I have heard people use subjects in the same tried and true mold and just not benefit the church very much. That has to be taken into consideration, along with other things, when you are considering the feeding of the flock. You don't want to feed the flock insipid food. You want them to get nourishing food. And that's very important. Animals don't grow well on an insipid diet. Christians do not grow to maturity on an insipid diet. There has to be some meat and potatoes in it, if you will. It can't all be jello. Point B, teaching must be varied. Young, old. Inexperienced, experienced. We need to hear all of these people. It doesn't hurt us in the least to listen to an inexperienced person do his best to edify us. That doesn't damage anyone, and it certainly helps him. We sometimes have to be a patient audience rather than an inspired audience. Sometimes we have to be a tolerant audience rather than a highly edified audience, because we don't all start off with a bang. We don't all start like Paul did. He had all the tools when God selected him. He was adult. He was grown. We don't all begin that way. And we have to be tolerant of each other, understanding with each other, patient with each other. But we need this variety, because variety is the secret of the church. It is many minds together that make up the church. This is how God wants it, and it is the expression of those many minds that is the greatest value to the church. Because we are a diversity of persons, but we're not to have diversity in doctrine. We come from different backgrounds. We have different sets of experience. In other words, our frames of reference don't all agree. And all of that is valuable to the church. That's an asset, not a liability. And we should see it that way, as a treasure, in a sense, of talent and ability that just needs to be developed, needs to be worked, channeled, and utilized. Let me comment on one more congregation before I leave this. This is a congregation that never has really tried to develop much talent within itself. I don't know why. There are certain persons who perform, and they perform over and over, and hardly anyone else gets an opportunity. I'm a little puzzled by that situation because I haven't been there very much, and I don't know for certain whether that is the fault of the leadership or whether that is a congregation full of very reluctant people. I'm not altogether certain, but I do know that that exists. Point number C, the teaching must be appropriate on all levels. That means that the teaching in the church goes from milk to strong meat, depending on the person, the situation, and the problem. There are some people who drink milk in one or two areas and can chew strong meat in some others. We need to know that this combination exists. In other words, we're not equally committed and informed in all areas. We might have an obstruction in some area, something that bothers us, it just kind of blocks us from developing very much of an understanding in certain areas. I might have had a very bad experience in hosting someone sometime, and I'm reluctant to do that again. I have a blockage there. I have an obstruction. I'm judging the whole community by the actions of one person. So the teaching has to be appropriate. We must understand, in other words, a person who's a giant in one area and a child in another. And incidentally, we all have some childish areas. That's a good part of growing up, of maturing, of getting over our childish attitudes. So the teaching must be appropriate to whatever level we're dealing with the individual, and also with the congregation. must be appropriate at all levels of understanding and knowledge if it's going to be effective. Now understand that expressing as I am these obligations of elders, I want you to understand that what I'm expressing is the possible. I don't expect an elder to be perfect, nor should you, because we are all human beings together. We all have feet of clay. We're all made of dust, not very noble material, and sometimes we demonstrate it clearly.